Welcome to Global Data Pod, JP Morgan's Economic Policy and Research Podcast. I'm your host, Nora Santivani, and joining me today is Michael Feroli, our Chief US Economist. Hi, Mike. Thanks for joining.
Hey, Nora, how are you?
I'm okay, thanks. All right, so in today's research wrap, we're going to discuss immigration. This is a topic that, as you noted, has been on a lot of people's minds. It's a subject of intense political debate, but I would say its wide-ranging economic effects are maybe less widely discussed or appreciated. So that's what we're going to be focusing on today. Mike has written a research piece on this topic. You know, he highlights that the surge in immigration over the past few years has profoundly affected many of the widely followed economic indicators we look at, right, including the closely watched U.S. jobs report. And it also explains some of the surprising strength of the U.S. economy and resolves a number of puzzles about the economy that we ourselves have been debating. So with that teaser out of the way, Mike, maybe let's first get a better handle on the numbers, right, the immigration numbers that we're dealing with. There have been so many different estimates of the size of immigration flows that I've seen, at least in different, you know, places. And some of these look very large. So, you know, what is the size of these flows? How reliable are they? We can go into like different sources later on, but first maybe just a sort of a broader perspective of these flows.
So I guess just to level set, I mean, I think that something we feel pretty confident we know is that, let's say in the decade prior to the pandemic, immigration had been running a little under 1 million per year. Most of that, you know, legal, lawful, permanent residence, green card status, so forth. Now, after the pandemic, we sort of got some hints that things were picking up in terms of immigration. So, I mean, I guess first that we all agreed that in 2020, immigration kind of came to a standstill because of the restrictions on flows of people around the world. So after the pandemic, we were getting some hints that immigration was picking up. As I said, the fraction of the workforce that was foreign born really started to accelerate. Now, again, that was a hint, but measuring immigration in real time is tricky, in part because a lot of immigration is, you know, what might variously be called undocumented, illegal, though actually a lot of the non-lawful permanent resident immigration recently has not necessarily been illegal because of some of the Biden era asylum policies didn't make it, you know, officially illegal, but so kind of in that gray area that's a little tougher to measure. But, you know, I think interest in this topic really got accelerated by a recent CBO estimate where they pulled together data from Customs and Border Protection. And they came up with a number that after, again, remember I said we were kind of averaging a little below a million, that over the past few years, in particular in 2023 and 24, it's picking up to over 3 million, almost 3.5 million. And then we kind of noted that you can use some information from the non-farm payroll report to also kind of infer a population growth. And it actually comes out with a number very similar to what CBO has. So it does seem like we've really, population growth is really ramped up. And again, I guess maybe I should have mentioned this at the outset. Right now, immigration is a big part of population growth because, like most developed economies, the nativity trends, the domestic nativity and mortality trends are such that, that's adding, a tenth or two to population growth, whereas immigration is now almost 1%. So the vast majority of population growth that we're looking at over the past 2 or 3 years is immigration. But even, you know, going back pre-pandemic, it was still a big chunk.
Yeah, I was going to ask you for a little bit of historical context. I mean, I understand there's been this surge in the past 2 to 3 years. I mean, to me, that's not all that surprising, right? You would have expected a big drop on, you know, at the onset of the pandemic, then you would have expected it to rebound, you know, and it's not that surprising that maybe immigration has rebounded so strongly, especially as a larger share of those immigrants might be in the services sector after the reopening of the, you know, of the services sector in the US economy. I mean, these numbers you're mentioning, how do they compare?
Actually, I guess I would say if I went back maybe a year or two, year and a half, maybe I would have said, yeah, this might just be catch up from a period of very unusually low immigration. But I think now when you look at the numbers, it's, you know, it's much greater than can be explained just by like filling in that, you know, that 1 year divot that in 2020.
We're running above where we were pre-pandemic. So certainly this 3 million number, if it's correct, that would be significantly above. And then, like, what share of the labor force is that? And if you could talk us through maybe labor force participation, how that might differ between foreign-born and native-born, and what are you seeing this, what sort of effect is it having on the participation rate and the overall labor force?
Yeah, so it gets a little tricky here. So the participation rate of foreign-born tends to be greater than that of native borns by about 5 percentage points, 4 or 5 percentage points, something like that. So it's something like 67% for foreign born, 62 for native, or 66, 60, you know, 61, 62. That being said, there is some evidence that for, you know, for the newest immigrants, it's actually below native, right? So now that may be a little different now because, again, some of the Biden era policies have allowed people to get work permits basically within a few months of arriving in the country, which wasn't the case previously. So, you know, I think for our purposes, you know, I think it's fine just to approximate the labor force participation rates of these immigrants to that of the overall population, which is around, you know, 60% or so, which then gets into the issue of how much is this, you know, adding to the workforce and the, you know, the potential workforce. And I guess the, you know, just to cut to the punchline, you know, in the pre-pandemic period or 2 or 3 years ago, we would have projected that the number of jobs needed to satisfy the just the regular growth in the workforce was probably about 100,000 jobs per month. You know, estimates can be plus or minus, you know, 25 or 50K. With the immigration numbers we're seeing last year and this year, that number is probably double, so closer to 200,000. Again, you know, plus or minus a little bit. But again, I think that helps reconcile why, you know, we've been seeing these job, you know, really strong jobs numbers over the last year without a move lower in the unemployment rate. If anything, the unemployment rate's actually, you know, ticked up a little bit. You know, early on in this recovery, it had been, well, you could see that kind of growth because participation rates for the overall participation rate was rebounding a lot. It's leveled off over the past, you know, year, but now, you know, you're still, you know, having these sustainably strong job numbers in large part because, I think, because of what we're seeing on the immigration.
Right. So the, yeah, so the punchline, as you say, is that the sort of break-even or sustainable pace of job growth is higher than perhaps we and other people previously thought coming into this cycle. I mean, if you think about where the pace of job gains are running now, what is it, like 230 to 50,000 roughly? Is that right?
Yeah.
So we're still, it sounds like we're still running above this 200,000 number that you mentioned, and yet the unemployment rate has started moving up. So to me, that would suggest maybe the break-even rate could be, I don't know, even higher than 200,000. I don't know if that's right, but I mean, what's your sense in terms of what we're seeing in the most recent data, or is it kind of quite hard to pin it down so precisely?
I wouldn't want to put, you know, with these things, I wouldn't want to put too fine a point on like looking at, you know, the most recent numbers, because you're going to have issues with, you know, differences between household and establishment survey. But, you know, also I would say, Really for much of the second half of last year, we're running pretty close to 200 on jobs. So that kind of feels about right. I mean, yeah, the average moved up because of February number. But before the February number, through my bad, it's pretty close to 200,000.
Okay, yeah, so there's a bit of noise in it. Okay, so either way, it suggests that maybe we don't need to see such a big step down in payroll growth to get that loosening in the labor market, right? That we previously thought, right? Previously, we're thinking maybe job growth steps down quite substantially, and that would be kind of required in a way to get that loosening in the labor market and move up in the unemployment rate. But as you're suggesting, it could be that this, we continue with these stronger run rates for a while longer, right?
Yeah, that's
yeah. Okay. All right. So maybe some of the other implications here, one that you highlight in your note is faster trend growth, right? Workers are obviously boosting output growth, right? As long as this immigration surge continues. I don't know if we can give an estimate of what this implies for trend growth, but maybe you could, just give us a rough guide to where you thought it was before, where it might be now.
And then
second would be the implication for labor productivity, which you and I chatted a bit briefly on, but that's another aspect I'm quite interested in.
Yeah. So, I guess, well, I'll give you the short answer and maybe a little bit longer answer. So immigration, pre-pandemic, the trend, you're probably adding about 2 to 3 tenths per year in trend growth in hours worked. Now that's probably at least double that. So you might say, well, then add 2 or 3 tenths or maybe a little more to your estimate of trend GDP growth. Now, the longer answer is, what do we mean by trend? Trend, I usually think of something like that you want to extrapolate, you'd feel comfortable extrapolating out, a couple of years, at least 3 years or so into the future. And, immigration is very, I think you briefly alluded to the politics here, but immigration is very policy sensitive, and policy, as everyone knows, could change after the election. So I wouldn't necessarily say trend growth is going to be 2 or 3 or 4 tenths stronger. I would say right now and probably through the end of the year, it's boosting the potential non-inflationary growth of the economy by that much. So,
okay,
yeah,
and
maybe
then
that's too semantic, but
and then okay, so with that, does it influence the dots? Near-term dots, long-term dots. What are the implications there? Because a lot of what we've been discussing amongst ourselves suggests that the U.S. economy looks like it can withstand higher policy rates than commonly thought, and all this suggests that R star is higher than we previously thought. I mean, how does this sort of immigration surge? It sounds like you see this more as a shorter term dynamic that might not sustain through the longer term.
So there's that. And then I think the other issue is when I think about the dots and when I think about Fed policy, recently it has been overwhelmingly dominated by the one side of the mandate that's getting it wrong, which has been inflation. And so then I think the question becomes, how does immigration affect the inflation story? My conclusion, and for what it's worth, I mean, independently, I know Chair Powell said the same thing, I think, which is that to a first approximation, immigrants add to supply and demand, and therefore that should kind of wash out in inflation. Inflationary consequence. In other words, yes, immigrants are adding to labor supply, which may be relieving some of the pressure in the labor market. On the other hand, immigrants buy things and that they consume. So you might think, all right, well, it's a wash. Now, there are stories you could tell going in either direction. Like you might say, well, no, it's more disinflationary because immigrants remit some of their earnings back to family members, and so they don't add to demand. But then you could say on the inflationary side, well, immigrants, probably have a higher marginal propensity to consume. You could also say that, the supply adjustment in things like housing is probably, you know, sluggish because it takes time to, you know, permit and so forth to get supply to meet demand. So, but that is another, you know, for what it's worth, another implication here is that we've kind of had a surprisingly tight housing market in terms of vacancy rates, in spite of pretty good number of delivered completed housing units. But anyway, getting back to the inflation story, I think to, you know, maybe it's a tenth one way up or down, but big picture, I don't think the immigration story, while it's first order for a lot of things, I don't think it's first order for inflation. And inflation, you know, I think is what's really driving Fed policy.
Okay. How about rental inflation? Because as you point out, immigrants increase demand for housing. And we have seen stickiness in rental inflation. I'm not saying that's necessarily all down to immigration, but do you think it's having an impact there? And, you know, that might suggest it could take a bit longer for that part of inflation to come down. Is that the right way of looking at it?
I think that's potentially, you know, that's potentially a story. Now, you know, in the long run, inflation is about the overall price level, not about relative prices, right? And rent is a relative price. So that said, you know, in the short runs, you know, inflation may be partly a story of, you know, co-movement of relative prices. You know, look at that again, going back a few years, we would have thought the demand for housing units was something like, you know, 1 million housing units a year, roughly. And we've been delivering, you know, around 1.5 million recently, and yet you haven't seen vacancy rates move higher. So I do think,
yeah,
you know, the immigration story probably is part of what's keeping that, you know, housing shortage from being relieved just yet.
Right. And then the other aspect you mentioned is stronger state and local government spending, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what's your sense? I mean, is there some numbers, magnitude we can put on that? Clearly that adds to overall, you know, aggregate demand. And
No, so I wish there were. I think one of the issues with state and local governments for non-domestic listeners is that there are, I believe, over like 4,000 municipalities in the U.S. when you count cities and counties, and of course, 50 states. So tallying up things for state and local governments is, you know, beyond the capabilities of J.P. Morgan Economics. But, you know, if you just take a sampling of some of the, you know, larger cities and states, you know, you can get to some, you know, you start to measure things very, very soon in billions and tens of billions and perhaps more. But one thing we know is that state and local government spending has been one of the outperforming areas of the economy. We know that state and local governments are, you know, begging Washington for some relief on this, on the fiscal side. So that may be one of the you know, another one of the consequences. But it is a consequence that right now I don't have a good number on, and hopefully, but I wouldn't be surprised over time, because this is becoming such a central issue on both sides of the aisle, that I think we should be able to quantify it better. But right now I don't have a great answer on that.
Okay, labor productivity. Obviously, we've seen strong gains in labor productivity. I was suggesting to you that, you know, could it be that the immigration surge is somehow contributing to these stronger labor productivity gains, partly because my sense was, and then you told me I was misguided on this, was that perhaps, you know, either the number of immigrants in the employment statistics was mismeasured or underreported, or the hours worked might not be measured correctly, so that it could actually have the effect of boosting measured labor productivity. Now, you told me that's all wrong. Can you tell us, you know, why are you so confident that these numbers are adequately or thoroughly measured? And what is the implication for labor productivity from immigration, in your view?
I wouldn't say you were all wrong or that I'm confident. But one thing I would say is, all right, so productivity is output divided by hours. The hours we get for that calculation are mostly from the establishment survey, so the one that we get the non-farm payroll report from. I think there are two reasons to believe that that's actually getting most immigrants. or immigrant hours worked. One is that of this current vintage of immigrants, it's believed that about 2/3 actually probably get work permits within, you know, a short time of arriving in the country. Think, you know, mostly because of Biden era policies. And the other reason to believe that they're being measured is that the non-farm payroll number is benchmarked to the universe of unemployment insurance tax receipts. And the penalty for not, you know, if you hire an undocumented worker, you know, in most places, probably a bit of a slap on the wrist. But if you don't pay their UI taxes, it's a bigger penalty. So even undocumented workers are probably getting their UI taxes paid. So I think the number is probably, I think the hours worked is probably measuring it that pretty decently for immigrants as well. Now, so then coming back to the broader question on productivity, you know, one of the determinants of productivity is labor compensation composition, right? So if your workforce becomes more skilled and educated, that should in principle boost productivity, right? So, you know, a factory with very unskilled workers is going to be less productive than one where they're all expert machinists with, you know, trained experience and all that. So what we know about the, you know, the likely composition of the latest vintage, given very, you know, it's not, most of them are not lawful permanent green card holders, is that they're probably below average skill and education. And if anything, they're probably dragging on labor quality and labor composition. So the fact that we have had good productivity growth over the past year, I think, is even more notable given that labor quality has probably, you know, suffered a little bit.
All right, so let's talk a bit about the elections, just because I'm sure everybody is asking that question, so we should address it. Immigration is going to be an important issue in the upcoming election, perhaps the most important issue. Now, if Trump wins, you know, the suggestion is that we could see more of a reversal in these immigration inflows. I mean, how do you see the outlook for immigration maybe changing under the different scenarios or different presidential outcomes? Does it matter who wins?
So it does, you know, and I should mention I'm taking most of my guidance here from our friends in DC who know more about this, but you know, the I think probably to nobody's surprise, if Trump is elected, you know, the Biden era policies will get overturned. You'll go back to the Trump era policies, perhaps with even more of a emphasis on border security, given that it's probably going to be, you know, even more central to his campaign than it was in 2016. And then perhaps a little, you know, a little surprisingly is that even if Biden were reelected, you could expect to see immigration policy also turn a little more restrictive, if for no other reason than you know, the bipartisan border bill, which kind of died in Congress. The thinking down in D.C. is that it would be more likely to pass if Biden were reelected and Trump were not elected, and then therefore Trump's ability to kind of block that bill, you know, wouldn't be there, and therefore, you know, the bill would pass. Now, the bill would mostly just provide more, you know, money to CBP to enforce, so it might be like a slower ramp down in immigration numbers under Biden than under Trump. But I think, you know, in either case, I would be hesitant to extrapolate the 23-24 numbers beyond this calendar year.
All right, Mike, shall we leave it there? I think we've covered good ground.
Sounds good.
I you know, I have loads more questions, but I think we're going to leave it there for today. So thanks, Mike, for joining me and sharing your thoughts. And thank you to our listeners. And we hope you can join us on the next episode of Global Data Pod. This communication is provided for information purposes only. Please refer to JP Morgan research reports related to its content for more information, including important disclosures. 2024 JP Morgan Chase & Company, all rights reserved. This episode was recorded on March 21, 2024.